Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's March. It's Thursday. It's about 20 to 11, and that means, of course, it's time to welcome Doug Rushkoff back to the studio for our weekly series this month, Open Source Living. We have been talking with Doug, known as kind of a new media guru since the 90s, about how new media has changed the way we think, do politics, teach our kids, and more, and what's good or bad or mixed about that. Today, interactive politics from Seattle 99 to Barack Obama and Reverend Wright today. Doug, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, good to see you.
Happy first day of spring.
Yeah, almost.
And today we're going to focus on interactive media and the democratic process. And I want to get your thoughts on the way in which you see participatory media affecting this election, especially. You were telling us that when you listened to the Obama speech, you keyed on a particular section. So we're going to cue that up.
We can play Reverend Wright's sermons on every channel, every day, and talk about them from now until the election, and make the only question in this campaign whether or not the American people think that I somehow believe or sympathize with his most offensive words. We can pounce on some gaffe by a Hillary supporter as evidence that she's playing the race card. Or we can speculate on whether white men will all flock to John McCain in the general election, regardless of his policies. We can do that. But if we do, I can tell you that in the next election, we'll be talking about some other distraction. And then another one. And then another one.
So what were you thinking when you heard that?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, in a lot of ways, the Obama campaign kind of represents a new media approach to issues compared with this kind of the old media approach that he's describing. You know, broadcast media was really created not so that, you know, Lucille Ball could send her comedy throughout the nation, but for products to be able to distribute brand messages across the country. You know, the mainstream media is a marketing vehicle, and marketing works by finding targets, target markets they're called, and then honing very specific messages, very emotional messages right to those markets.
Politics often works that way too these days.
Well, politics filtered through mainstream media is going to be exacerbated that way, so that, you know, television politics has become very much about, you know, finding your audience, whether it's your Fox News audience or your NPR audience or your MSNBC audience.
But also what's considered new media politics, like direct marketing. You saw, I'm sure, how sophisticated the Bloomberg reelection campaign was, for example. It had so much money to spend to find these micro target markets, you know, Latinos living on the west side of Manhattan making more than $100,000,
right,
and crafting campaign materials just for those micro markets.
Oh, and both the Bush and Kerry campaigns did that in the last election. I mean, they use very sophisticated computer modeling where you don't really know anything about the person, but you know if they have, you know, a two-door car and a cat instead of a dog, it means they're going to be, you know, more moderate than someone who's got three cats. And I mean, it was bizarre the correlations they found. So computers, you know, and the internet essentially can be used that way, but I look at the bias of the internet as towards participation, that people who have what I would consider a good, a legitimate internet experience start to look at politics differently, that an appropriate internet experience is an interactive one. It's a participatory one. It's one in which you feel as welcome to write and to share and to broadcast what you're thinking as to read what someone else is saying. You know, while radio, like we're on, is you can call in, but the bias of radio is towards us sitting behind the microphones. The bias of the internet really is towards participation, which speaks to a very different kind of politics, a different kind of political leadership. So where traditional media would promote a candidate who argues, I can do this for you, I can be a good leader, I will help the country, an internet generation or an internet candidate would be more about, I can help give you access to government. I can help you participate in the government you want to have. And Obama is really, especially in this last speech, he made it very clear that the distinction between an old media candidate who will look to get elected by targeting specific demographics, Latinos, blacks, whites, people in this part of Philadelphia versus that, and an internet candidate who, although they could go that route, if they're going to use the media in the way that medium is biased, they're going to look more towards how do we create a broad coalition of participation and actually get people to cross and converse over formerly sacrosanct boundaries.
So in Obama's case, the new media giveth and the new media taketh away, right? Because he's been so spectacularly successful at raising money from a lot of small donors on the internet, forging this new coalition. His YouTube views are off the chart compared to any candidate except Ron Paul, and, you know, other measures like that. People blogging about Obama, unbelievable. These things have been measured. And
at the same time,
Reverend Wright. All of a sudden now, Reverend Wright gets passed around. And I think it's the first time that Obama is really getting burned a little bit by the web.
Well, he is getting burned and he's not. I mean, in a sense, the internet not only allows the kind of participation and conversation to happen, it forces that kind of participation and conversation to happen. So Reverend Wright forces Obama to be the real internet candidate at this point, okay? You know, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword, but the way he responded to it, you know, to politics aside, the way he responded to it was actually not in a traditional news cycle. He didn't respond to it, and this is why the traditional news mainstream media is so upset with him. It's like, well, you didn't answer the question. What do you think about that thing? What do you think about that? You know, that's the way you're supposed to do it on a regular broadcast channel. What he did instead was decide, how would I, as president, respond to this cultural crisis? So what he did was he served as a leader. He said, well, what this actually is an opportunity to have a race conversation. I've been in barbershops. I've seen this stuff happen. That this is what, as president, I would do if this kind of crisis came up, is tell people how do we address it.
Though there's also political calculation in that, in distancing the conversation from the direct questions of,
well, there's political.
Did you know about these things? Were you truthful previously about what you knew about these comments? And how much do they represent within
your heart? There's political benefit from it. We don't know whether it's calculation or a lucky side effect of his you know, longstanding tendency to try to rise above kind of clash-oriented issues and move to this other thing. I mean, it reminds me very much this sort of moment of miscomprehension or incomprehension about, well, what is he doing? What is he saying? Or who are these Obama people? Reminds me, you brought it up, of the WTO protests in 99. And I used to watch them on the news, and I used to watch them on CNBC, the finance channel. And the broadcasters would sort of ridicule the whole thing, saying, well, look, there's a sign for the environment. There's a sign for labor. There's a sign about China. These people, they don't know what they're talking about. And what they couldn't understand was that you could actually have a coalition of people in the internet era who aren't all from the same special interest, who actually share a broader common interest.
We can take some phone calls for Doug Reschkoff on all this. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or, of course, and appropriately, on our comments page at WNYC.org. I haven't followed, and I don't know if you have yet, or maybe it's too soon to even know, whether bites of the Obama speech have started to circulate as hits on YouTube. We saw after those victory speeches that he gave in Iowa that moved so many people, and there was another one a few primaries later, I forget which one, that were, I think it was New Hampshire actually, even though he lost, that were excerpted and then viewed millions of times.
Right. I actually, we've been researching this one over the last 2 days to see, because when you watch television, you see only basically that one bite about his response to how many, you know, whether he liked this guy or not, and that he doesn't like what he said, but he's not going to get rid of the guy. And then everyone talks about that. So it's that same 10 seconds they keep playing. The main YouTube version, which is the entire speech, has so far been viewed like 1.9 million times. And that's the long version. So in this case, it's kind of funny because we always thought of the internet as making these things more piecemeal. In this case, the internet is giving people a chance to see the long form because they can only see the short form on
TV. Now, the speech, and we had a whole show special on it the day it happened. We aired the whole thing and previewed it and took comments afterwards. The speech was 35 minutes. Mm. Now, YouTube itself, I think, limits excerpts to 10 minutes, limits YouTube posts to 10 minutes. So you're saying, and I know YouTube also does not
put it in chapters.
I believe that something is not considered as viewed unless somebody views to the end of the clip.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that over a million people have gone and watched the whole 35
minutes.
Closer
to 2 million than one, about 1.9 million
uh-huh.
now.
And what does that tell you?
That tells me that there are people who are interested. I'm not saying that these are necessarily supporters or not, but they heard there was some big speech and, you know, and that it had something to do with race, and they want to see it in its entirety, that people have a longer attention span than currently than their mainstream media will permit them to exercise.
Let me play a clip of the liberal blogger Marcus Melitzis, founder of Daily Kos, speaking last year at his yearly COS convention about politics and Netroots.
It's one thing to talk about people power politics, to write about it, to read about it. It really is another thing completely to see it. And these have been good, heady days for the people powered movement. We're only 4 years old. From the early days when bloggers like Atrios and Jerome Armstrong of Mighty D inspired people like me and many other bloggers to stop railing at the television, stop throwing pillows at Hannity and Combs, stop complaining about Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, stop complaining about the pathetic so-called liberals that were supposedly speaking for us in D.C., and take what we felt, that passion, that energy, and start you doing that online.
You want to react to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. There's actually going to be, I'll do a plug for them. There's a conference in New York in April called the Personal Democracy Forum. PDF, 2009. I'm going to be speaking at that, and some really weird and interesting people are going to be there.
I thought it's in June, and I'm going to
maybe
be
it is in June.
I'm going to be
is
doing something at it also.
Maybe I'm doing something
June
else.
June 23rd and 24th at Lincoln Center, Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Okay,
but maybe they're doing another one.
No, it must be that. I mean, I don't. I'm not calendrical anymore. I have a child.
You.
It's all over.
I'll see you there.
It's spring, I hear. The interesting thing about that, I'm speaking about this thing I wrote a long time ago called Open Source Democracy. And what I think is important to do is to distinguish between sort of online venting through text and actual participation in the democratic process through the internet. You know, sometimes I feel like there's so much blog energy being expended that people think of blogging their opinion as a substitute for taking action on the ground in a real and local way. You know, feet on the ground, bodies standing in front of the White House still really says more in a way than millions of blogs arguing the same point. You know, I'm having a chapter in my next book. It's called Let Them Eat Blog. You know, that a dictator in power on a certain level, if they're a dictator in a democracy, doesn't really care if we're all blogging against him.
We've gobbled up almost all our time. Let me get a couple of callers in here. Joe in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Doug Rushkoff. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Brian. It was interesting for me how he described the Seattle crowd as sort of a internet era-based community. And I was wondering, did they have more or less the same type of movements in France and at Italy? Has he compared that or... Is this just the U.S. based?
No, I mean, they're all internet enabled at this point. I mean, until very recently, the only way you could get people together was by having a very common and specific cause. So it's easy to get people motivated and marching if it's, you know, against abortion or for abortion or against, you know, blocking this stream or this thing. Now, in the U.S., in Germany, in Israel, in South Korea even, a lot of the protests you see are bigger because they're really amalgamations of people who have, you know, different different personal issues, different group issues, but they understand how they're all connected, either as anti-corporate or anti-central government.
Let me get one more in. Aaron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I kind of disagree that this has increased participation. I mean, I spend plenty of time, wasting my time, I guess, on blogs, just reading opinions, completely polarized. And when you blog in many of these sites, you actually get banned. I mean, I've messed around with newsbusters.org, just kind of, you know, playing with them. These are very right-wing kind of Russian inbound people, and I've been banned very quickly from there.
But let me get a response. Important point that a lot of people raise about the polarization of politics, because people talk to like-minded folks on the web.
Right. Well, any digital medium is going to be necessarily polarizing. I mean, that's what digital means. It's that it's bits. It's yes, no. Rather than an analog medium where you're in a room with people, you can't quite disagree the same way. That's definitely true. And that's one of the biases of the internet
that
people
goes
have
against,
to understand.
So how do you get past that? Because that goes against the whole rising above the immediate issue and bringing people together for a larger discussion that you liked about the Obama speech.
You get past that by, actually, this is what I've been arguing for all along, is by learning the biases of the different programs you're using, by learning how is this forum put together, how is that forum put together, not just who's paying for it and who's sponsoring it, but how do the rules of conduct affect the ability to have a good conversation. And that's what we're really learning slowly over time on the internet, is that anonymous posting by anyone at any time really doesn't lead to the highest level conversation.
Douglas Rushkoff will be back for one more of these conversations next Thursday at the same time as we talk about open source living. Thanks a lot, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, you can keep this conversation going on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.